on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial President, Financial Advisor Steve Peasley.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. It is August 11th, 2015, and I'm here with Justin Klein today.
Did you almost say 1915?
I almost said 19-something. That's where my mind is. I'm reading this article just before the show, and it kind of threw me off with the numbers.
Gotcha. Was it talking about the 90s?
No, but it's talking about numbers.
Ah, gotcha.
So thank you very much for tuning in. We welcome everybody on radio, streaming live, or investtalk.com. I appreciate you listening. iTunes, tunein.com for podcasters and other outlets. On InvestTalk, we mostly focus on the smaller day-to-day decisions that we have to make about, you know, what we're going to do with our stocks. Are we going to buy? Are we going to sell? Are we going to hold? But we really have to step back and look at the bigger picture from time to time to give ourselves some perspective. And as I said in my market commentary on InvestTalk.com, the stock market for 2015 has been pretty flat, very flat, with China's slow, and I said that that's really surprising that it's flat. You think about it. What have we had the first half of the year? We had the China slowdown. We had the EU problems with Greece. We have the Federal Reserve threatened to raise interest rates. And with those things, you would think the market would at least produce a decent correction, and it has not. And, of course, we are in the summer months when corrections tend to start, and we haven't seen it yet.
A lot of individual stocks. Yes. Actually, I would say probably close to the majority of stocks in the market have had at least a 20% correction.
But there is a lot that have corrected, but the overall market has not.
Yeah, because it's been driven by, you know, the
two sectors,
healthcare and technology.
It's consumer discretion and healthcare, both are up 10%, whereas utilities are down 10%. I don't know about technology. I'm not sure.
That's still done decently well, but it's also trading pretty sideways.
Pretty flat.
You have the sell-off in January, a big rally in February, and ever since then, the market's been extremely choppy.
Yeah. So 8 of the 10 major corrections are down or flat, basically.
The only sectors.
Two are really up
nicely.
8 of the
10 sectors, you said.
Huh?
8 of the 10 sectors.
Yes. Yeah. Is that what I said?
You said 8 of the 10 corrections.
Oh, so then, yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay, this market could stay with us for a while. This kind of market. It doesn't have to correct. It doesn't have to rally. It could do this for a lot longer. We don't know. No one knows.
Yeah, we're certainly at a point where either the market's going to consolidate, which is what it's doing, to move higher, or it's weakening to, you know, move lower.
You could say consolidating to move lower.
Well, usually consolidating move lower is usually after a fall, you know, and it consolidates and then moves lower again. So we've had a big move up, and is it consolidating to move higher? Well, we're about to find out, I think, soon.
So, you know, I think if we got a decent rally now and into the fall, we probably would have a decent move up to the end of the year. But without that rally, all bets are off. I mean, without that correction, all bets are off. Mm-hmm. You know, we need that correction. Okay, let's get right to work answering some questions. You can get through to us during this hour, 888-99-CHART. If you'd like to get a question between times, call the same number. Let's take that question that came in before today's program.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Justin. I am a podcast listener from New York. I've been listening to your show for 2 years now, and you both have helped me make good investments and become a better investor. So thank you. I've started to use charts to help me pick entry and exit points. I currently use the free service on a website called marketvolume.com to get support and resistance numbers. I have two chart questions. One, would you recommend using daily, weekly, or monthly charts for my analysis? And two, I have heard you use the term strong support for a stock. Is that something that I can figure out or find on the internet? Thanks very much, and I'll listen to your answer on the next podcast. Bye.
Okay, well, let's start with what chart we use.
I think the first thing you have to realize is charting, it's an art, not a science.
Right.
And there's a lot of yeses, buts, and nos, buts. And he said, you know, should you use daily or weekly chart? And I would say both.
Well, we start with a daily chart, a mm-hmm. one-year daily chart. Okay, that's where we start and look at the pattern. Mm-hmm. And then we would go to a weekly chart to support or refute what we see in a daily chart, mm-hmm. to give us a longer-term look.
And the bigger the chart pattern, the more solid that chart pattern is going to be. You know, if it's in a longer-term trend, generally that trend will stay, even though short-term, daily, it can become bearish for whatever reason. But over a broad sense, you want to use the longest chart pattern as possible. Think about, you can go look at a five-minute chart. You know, we can with systems.
Or and 1 minute, 5 minute, 60 minute. Mm-hmm.
And short term, 5 minute chart, it can look very bullish, but the daily, weekly, and monthly look very bearish, but you're not going to go off this 5 minute chart. So the longer, the better.
Yeah, the short chart, 5 minute, 60 minute, 1 minute, those are day traders. That's what they use those. Mm-hmm. And the next question you have is, where can you find
support and resistance? There's various types of support and resistance. Some are based on moving averages. Daily, weekly, monthly moving averages. Some are based on Fibonacci levels. That's another tool that traders use. Others are pivot points, where a chalk usually went up to and sold off at, or went down to and rallied from. Those are pivot points. So there's a lot of different types of support and resistance.
But that doesn't tell you how to find them, how to learn about them. You need to read. They get some books on technical analysis and that.
On our website, there's I think we have about 5 books listed that we recommend people read to just kind of get a sense of technical analysis.
And one of them is a major. I think it's by McGee. It's a very mm-hmm.
popular.
It's almost like a textbook on charting.
So yeah.
That's where you learn to do that.
Yeah. So that charting is something you learn over a long period. How many charts have you looked at, and over how many years?
Yeah, millions.
Yeah.
I don't know how many. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at lots of charts every day.
I mean, I look at hundreds a day.
Yeah. So, I mean, I spend at least an hour in the morning looking at charts.
Yeah.
So, the common myths keep people from building a basic portfolio. If you ever plan on retiring, you'll need that portfolio, trust me, and you need it to grow. Fact-checking 5 wrong ideas about investing. That's going to be our main talking point today. I have others. U.S. home prices rose in 93% of the metropolitan areas during the second quarter. Where do you think it rose the most? And where do you think it fell the most?
And is that year over year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And remember, I want to talk about the yuan. The Federal Reserve rate hike and the Chinese yuan. How are they related? Let's talk about how they can be related. And I want to talk about high-yield bonds. I don't know if you've talked about them.
I did not, but today was a pretty, important day.
Yeah, I think you need to look at the high-yield bond, and we're going to do that using JNK, which is an ETF for the junk bond. And I think it's kind of important that we look at those. Look at the high-yield bonds as to what's going on in the market. And those are the things we're going to talk about, but what's on your mind? What is interesting that strikes your fancy about anything financial? We'll discuss it. The market gave back almost all its gains yesterday, down 212 points on the Dow, down 65 points on the NASDAQ, down 20 points on the S&P 500. So between yesterday and today, the market was virtually flat.
And there was a couple key indicators that I talked about yesterday on the show on why yesterday's rally wasn't quite as bullish as a lot of people would have considered. One is what I talked about yesterday, which was that the S&P and the Dow actually performed the best, whereas the NASDAQ and the small caps didn't perform nearly as well. So, and I said yesterday, you want to see those two indexes outperform on up days and down days, and that will give you more of a bullish tone. Whereas if they underperform on up days and down days, that's more of a bearish tone. So you saw the give back because of that, and that was a small indicator yesterday, and the light volume.
Yeah.
There was not really a lot of conviction with the rally yesterday.
Yeah, so there was the big up day yesterday with not a lot of volume,
mm-hmm.
and a big down day today with a bit more volume, but not a huge amount of volume, but more than it was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of in, you know, kind
and,
of.
And what was today? Today was actually pretty decent volume. The highest volume on the SPY really since little late July 27th of last month. And then the small caps, that was the biggest savior today. Small caps didn't do that bad, but the NASDAQ did. The NASDAQ was the worst index, down 1.75%, where the S&P was down less than 1%.
InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial. One of our most popular investment programs is our Balanced Income Program. This investment approach primarily focuses on attaining an income stream through stable dividend-paying companies and quality corporate bonds. It also has a growth component, but that's a secondary consideration. You can find more about it on InvestTalk.com or call us at 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. So what are some of the, I want to call them, I guess, myths, common myths about the stock market?
Or about investing.
About investing, I guess. One of them that is very common is you need a lot of money to invest. Not these days, you don't.
No, mutual funds are so accessible. Through
ETFs?
Yeah, through brokerage firms. ETFs are hard for me because a lot of times if you only have like $1,000 and you have to, you know, you're going to put all that $1,000 into the S&P, SPY maybe, and you're going to pay a $10 commission, that's 1% of your portfolio just to get in.
I know, but if you leave it alone, and remember, you're keeping, you know, you, at least you have exposure to a broad market as opposed to my first stock. There was no such thing, you know. When I was 21, and I bought GM, I paid more in commission than I could afford in stock.
Jesus.
Yes, 50, and they still took my money, which I think, well, why did that guy take my money?
It was 500. They want their commission.
It was $500. Yeah.
Cost $500 to make that trade.
I spent $500, and over $250 was commission.
Wow.
What a rip.
That's crazy.
They didn't have mutual funds back then. Well, they may have, but well, he should have recommended
it. But that's why I think if you have a small amount of money, stick with mutual funds. No transaction costs. You can still get access to broad indexes, which if you don't have a lot of money, that's probably what you should be investing in anyway.
Yeah, but mutual funds cost more money every year than an ETF.
A lot of the index ones are very, very cheap.
That's
true. The Vanguard ones are extremely cheap.
That's true.
So you don't really need a lot of money. And I think the most important thing is that it's do it consistently. Yeah, and that's a lot of people's, their excuse up front is, I don't have a lot of money to invest. Well, if you put in $500 this quarter and then $500 next quarter and keep doing that year after year, well, guess what? That'll add up to a lot of money over time.
Another myth, investing is too risky. Well, not if you're young and you got lots of years.
Well, it also depends on what you're putting in it. Investing is very general.
Yeah, if you put it in a penny stock, you're going to lose all your money. Chances are very high.
Yeah.
You buy ExxonMobil, you're not going to lose your money. Yeah. How much money you'll make is another issue, but. Yeah.
Well, you can lose, obviously ExxonMobil's gone down now, but you can lose money over short periods of time. But there's various shades of risk. Like you said, penny stock, very high risk. Big blue chips like ExxonMobil and, you know, Procter & Gamble, sure, you might lose some money in the short term, but you're never going to lose all your money, right?
Yeah. And another one is you can beat the market. That's extremely difficult when people try to time the market, get in and out and in because I can beat the market. That's not going to work. Yeah. It's not going to work. Most 99.9% of all people.
There are great managers out there, you know, Warren Buffett's of the world. There are other big hedge fund managers and traders that have beaten the market over long periods of time. But those are very well-educated people with a lot of market experience and a lot of money to back them up. So it's difficult for the average person to beat the market, but that's why you're here to listen to us.
Keeping an eye on companies. General Electric Company says it would sell its U.S. healthcare finance unit to credit card lender Capital One Financial Corp. for about $9 billion, would it be, as it winds down its financial arms. Should that be of interest to you? Let's talk about it today. 888-99-CHART.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. A closer look at the three most often heard names in the investment universe. Index fund, an ETF, or a mutual fund. Which one works best for you? That's our talking point for Wednesday's podcast. Bring your questions and join us then.
888-992-4278. Don't save your questions if you have a question. You know, even if it's about the basics, we're here for you. Just give us a call. Whether you're an experienced investor or a beginner, 888-992-4278.
Hey, guys. Chris from Mobile. I've had a quick question, kind of a broad question on four companies, and want to get your take on those four and kind of what direction you would go if you don't have a position in any of these. But talking about Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, just want to get y'all's take on the companies as a whole. Also, if you took one position, what would that be and why? Thanks a lot.
Justin, he started off with just a quick question. Then he gives us four companies that are high, big blue-chip tech companies.
That's never quick.
That's not going to be quick. It's not. Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, and Google, of course, are all big blue-chip, headline-grabbing stocks.
Okay? And this is really what's been driving the market. These are pretty much the four that have been driving the market higher: Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, and Google. And they're all very expensive.
Yeah, there's no bargain in any of these. Should they be expensive? Well, they have good growth, pretty high growth. So, yeah, they should be pretty expensive. But how much should you pay for it? And as you know, we don't like to overpay for stocks.
Yeah, we're value investors. Yeah. Where the market right now, we talked about this recently, but growth stocks are drastically outperforming so far this year. Value stocks. And which kind of gives me shades of the 1999 era. Remember when nobody wanted to own value mutual funds and everybody wanted to own growth?
Well, I can't say it's the shades of it. That was insanity in 1999.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't say this is insane. This is just a little bit on the crazy side.
Well,
how's that?
Well, I think a lot of the sanity right now is in the private sector. Uber's worth 50-something billion.
Yeah, of those private, not public companies yet.
Exactly.
Ridiculous evaluations that is not any way close to reality. So are these are very good companies to own. I would love to own them, but I want a big correction or something to give me a better entry point, decent price. Not where they are now. I really like Google. I like Google a lot. And for the long haul,
if I was going to pick one, it would be Google. One of those four.
I think so too. Google would be my choice. Just not sure if if the market corrects, that might be a good time to pick it up. If it has, maybe then would be
the next bear market. These are going to get hit by this. I talk about this all the time. You know, a lot of these big high flying stocks, they are very, very business cycle sensitive, especially Google, Facebook, and Amazon. You know, Facebook is derived from their revenues derived from advertising, which is very cyclical. Same with Google. Advertising, very cyclical. Amazon, consumer spending, very cyclical. Netflix is probably the least cyclical.
Yeah, not as.
But they're also getting a lot of competition from the likes of Amazon with Amazon Prime and the cord cutters, which there's a lot of them out there. There's going to be more competition.
Think about Netflix. I mean, just looking at the fundamentals of Netflix alone, they're going to make 30 cents next year, 30 cents a share.
It's trading $122 a share.
Yeah.
A 300 P.
How can you do that?
Earnings are down 63% year over year.
See, it's just not reasonable. It's just not reasonable. Anyways, 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Okay, U.S. home prices rose 93% in 93% of the metro areas during the second quarter. And they're up last year was up, they were up 85% of the metropolitan area. So they actually improved from quarter to quarter. Okay, first quarter to the second quarter. And the price rose about 8.2%. So now try to remember that's looking backwards. Don't think that that's going to happen going forward. It's probably not. I think it's going to slow down. But what I found interesting in this report was the most expensive areas in the country. Number one, San Jose.
Not a shock.
Number two, that, by the way, is $980,000. The median existing single-family home price in San Jose is $980,000.
And we have a lot of clients in San Jose.
That's right. San Francisco, number two, $841,000. Anaheim, Santa Ana.
Which is pretty much
Orange County.
That's where we live.
Yeah, $685,000. And Honolulu at $698,000. San Diego's on the list at $547,000.
Wow.
Notice that they're all on the West Coast. or further west in Hawaii. The cheapest places, which is always interesting, Cumberland, Maryland, where the median single-family home price is $82,400. That's like a car.
We have an employee who put down 50% more than that about a week ago as a down payment on the house here.
Youngstown, Ohio area, $85,000. Rockford, Illinois, $94,000. Decatur, Illinois, $96,000. And Elmira, New York, $98,000. Those are the bottom of the list. Isn't that interesting? And look at the huge difference in prices. So if you live here in the United States, I mean, live here on the West Coast, and you've been buying your house and you've been buying it for 30 years and you got almost paid off, you could move to Buffalo, New York or someplace, Elmira, New York, and you could buy a huge house and pay off cash and live like a king. Of course, you have to put up with 6-foot snowdrifts, so, you know.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Just get a big shovel.
Wear gloves, get a shovel. This coming up on Invest Talk Personal, is a jumbo CD right for you? CD, certificate deposit. That's going to be the next half hour. We're here for you. We give you straight talk. We try our best to make sure we can answer your questions clearly. So give us a call, 888-99-CHART. This is Invest Talk, and of course, it's a two-way conversation. But if you have a question between programs, that's between them. We're live right now, 4 to 5 Pacific time, Monday through Friday. But between programs, you can still ask, and we'll answer it on the next Invest Talk. So we're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Hey, guys. My name is Robert. I'm a podcast listener. I love the show. I wanted to hear your guys' input on what is the Fed? What is your opinion of what is the Fed? Different people have said that it's not technically a form of our government, and I don't really understand it. I just want to know who funds the Fed. Yeah, whatever else you guys might know. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Federal Reserve is not an officially part of our government.
It is owned by its member banks, which are the large banks, J.P. Morgan's, Bank of America's of our country. And our federal government gives it its charter.
Yeah, it authorizes the Federal Reserve to do certain things. Mm-hmm. So it's not part of our government. Yeah. And when did they come into being? In the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. Okay, so don't think the Federal Reserve is part of a branch of government. It's not. Just like the IRS isn't.
Have you ever read the book Creature from Jekyll Island?
No.
It's a pretty interesting book. It's about the formation of the Federal Reserve.
Ah, no, I never read that. Yeah. And their charter, go ahead.
I'll give you a copy.
Okay. Their charter is they are supposed to do a couple of things, just really a couple of simple things, which you say simple, but they're not. And that is to kind of help keep full employment and try to keep a steady economy through controlling inflation. How they do that? Well, they raise and lower interest rates is the main arsenal that they use. Yeah.
They have other things that they can do, such as what they've done recently, which is QE, quantitative easing, which is purchasing assets. They can do that. They can also change what is called the reserve requirement. And you want to explain the reserve requirement?
You can do it, but I was going to mention that reserve requirement. But.
Yeah. So the reserve requirement is how much money banks have to hold on to as a percentage of what they lend. Right now, it's 10 to 1. For every $10 they lend, they have to keep $1 in deposits as a commercial bank.
So that
and
reserve,
they can change that.
Yeah, they changed that. And they did change it not that long ago during the financial crisis because banks were lending more money out than they felt comfortable with, and the banks got in trouble. Yeah. It's leverage. You know, and the Federal Reserve is there as a backstop for them. And that's not really if individual commercial banks, private banks, they're supposed to be on their own. If they go under, it's their own fault, and they let them go under. But in this latest financial crisis, that's not what happened.
Now, do you like the Federal Reserve?
Part of me thinks that we can get along without it. Mm-hmm. Part of me thinks that we can't. So it's a tough question. I'm not a big government person. I like small governments. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we really need the Federal Reserve. I'm reading Wealth of Nations, for everybody else.
Is this what, second, third time you read it?
Yes, this is the second time I read it. You know, it's huge, right?
Yeah.
It's,
huge.
It's upstairs on my bedstand. If I get tired and I can't fall asleep, I pick that up.
Oh, okay. Put you right to sleep.
Yeah. And it talks about how the economy works. And the more you read that book, the more you feel like, well, what do we need a Federal Reserve for?
My problem with the Federal Reserve is, like I said, it's owned by the member banks, the big banks. And they hold, and this is what happened in the financial crisis, they hold this specter of economic catastrophe if they don't get bailed out. That's what they did last time. So my question is, we go through another recession, they have maybe we have another financial crisis, right? Are they going to hold that above us again and make the taxpayers bail them out again?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. We've done it before this recent crisis. Mm-hmm. Why would we not do it again? You know they're going to do it.
They say, you either let the economy crash and we go into a depression, or you give us money and keep us whole.
Exactly. So you need to make the banks toe the line. And I do like a higher reserve, mm-hmm. because you need them to be more stable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is an argument that can go on forever.
Yeah, it's a very complex argument. But I'm not a big fan of the Fed myself. I think what they've recently done has been pretty reckless.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that, by the way, everybody. High yield bonds. Okay, there's two kinds of bonds. I mean, if you're talking about really generally speaking, the high yield sector are what is all commonly known as junk bonds.
Anything that's rated by S&P or the other rating agency as less than BBB.
And then there's the high quality bonds, the other side.
Yeah, BBB or higher would be investment grade bonds.
Okay, and of course, you know, treasuries, U.S. government treasuries and municipals, most of those are higher quality, okay? Mm-hmm. Most of the big corporations have higher quality bonds. The junk bonds are most of those corporations that have shaky or not as solid financial strength. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they have to pay a lot more interest when they issue a bond, because people are worried that they're not strong enough to pay back their money on a 5-year bond or a 10-year bond or whatever length of bond they issue. Therefore, high yield bonds pay higher yields. Dividend yields, well, we can't call them dividends, just call them yields, interest rate yields, yeah. Then quality. And because they have a higher default rate. One of the things that is concerning us is the default rate has been 1.5% to 2% in recent years, and it's projected that they're going to double that over the next few years.
And we've already seen that. You've seen some coal companies go out of business.
Yeah.
A lot of...
How about the oil companies and Shell Oil?
There's been a few oil companies going out of business, mainly coal, because coal is so hated and natural gas is so cheap, and it's usually a competitor to coal. And so, you know, that's really where the defaults have been. And that's going to increase, and you've seen that. The yield spreads is what is a treasury yielding for that same maturity versus what is that bond yielding, and that spread, that difference is the spread. And the higher the spread, the more risk averse the market is being. When those spreads are very low and very tight, which they have been over the past, you know, 3 years or so, it means that investors aren't really worried about default risk.
So the investors are worried about default risk, and you can see it very easily on JN. Okay, which is the ETF for junk bonds. You'll see that the market, if you remember right, the market corrected almost 10% last December, basically, mm-hmm. okay? And junk bonds corrected with them.
Yeah. Well, the market found low in October, but interestingly, if the junk bonds bottomed in December, a couple months later, I don't know why, but that's really where it sold off really into December.
That's right. So the junk bonds were delayed. Okay, so now the junk bonds made a recovery, and now they're worse or right at where they were before.
Yeah, they peaked below that December low and actually closed right at the low from December.
So the question you have to ask yourself, what did the junk bond buyers of bonds know that we don't about the stock market?
Usually the bond market is smarter than the stock market.
That has been historically has been the case.
Because the bond market is a group of institutional investors, right?
How many
individual people are going out there, the average person, in buying an individual bond?
Not a lot.
Very few. So it's usually institutions that are the ones that are buying and selling the bonds. And that's why the bond market's smarter.
And what's interesting is the broader bond market is actually improving a little bit, mm-hmm. whereas the junk bond market is deteriorating.
Yeah. And that shows that the bond investors are getting more risk averse. They're
exactly.
seeing more problems out there in the market than equity investors are.
Yep, that's how we see it. Does it mean that the stock market's going to collapse? No. It just means that it's just one more little signal out there. It's a little red flag, and there's a number of little red flags, and they seem to be building, and it's a concern.
Yeah, now, increases the risk is really what it does for the equity market.
And, of course, there's other flags that are green. Don't think it's all red. It's not. But, you know, we just got to be very, very aware.
It's an important red flag.
Yeah.
There's minor red flags, and there's important red flags.
It's time now for Vestalk Personal, the everyday decisions we make that have investing have lasting impact on your investing and your wealth. Is a jumbo CD a good choice to park your cash? And what is a jumbo CD? And have you ever heard that term, Justin, jumbo CD?
Yes, okay. Banks.
Because yeah. Most people in the last few years, no one cares about jumbo CDs. Never, so it's not talked about, never anywhere. Jumbo CD is where you have $100,000 or more in a certificate of deposit.
And the banks want your money very bad because it's a lot of money on one account very quickly, very easily, and they can lend on that $100,000, right? A 10-to-1 ratio. They can lend $1 million on that $100,000.
Yeah, they'd love you to have jumbo CD.
So they're going to pay you a higher interest rate than maybe if someone else brings them $5,000.
And you would think that that'd be the case.
Generally.
But it's not right now.
Because the trades are nothing.
Yeah. So right now, you can. It's almost worthless for you to buy a jumbo CB and think you're going to get a higher interest rate. You could buy an under jumbo CB, and the five-year rate is pretty much the same. The three-year rate is pretty much the same.
Well, also, there's excess reserves now. Remember we talked about how the Feds put all this money into the banks to help make them stronger?
Yep.
Well, they haven't been lending out enough.
They still have that money.
Yeah, they still have that money. So they don't really need more deposits. Yeah. So why are they going to pay more to get more deposits?
So they don't
really
care to attract you.
No.
They don't want it.
No.
So that's kind of interesting. So the point is here on Vestalk Personal is that it really is not it's not helping you to get a jumbo CD. So don't think it will. And if you want to read the article about it, there's an article on Motley Fool article on Vestalk.com. We have it posted there. And you can take a look at it and read it. That's InvestTalk Personal. If you have a question about real estate, anything financial, trust, wills, give us a call. 888-99-CHART. Or you can write me a note, write Justin a note. You go to contact Steve or contact Justin on InvestTalk.com.
There's a link to today's talking point. Just look for the Tuesday, August 11th heading on InvestTalk.com. Need help making an important money decision? Why not ask a professional financial advisor? 888-99-CHART is how to get through to Steve right now.
I have a question I wanted to ask. A position in the Franklin High Income Age Fund, and it is in an IRA that I put in years ago, but I'm looking to sell. Wanted to know what your opinion is. I'm not going to retire yet, maybe I have maybe 10 to 15 years, but want to know if I should sell now or a portion or stay with its junk bond fund. Thank you.
Well, that kind of fit into what we just talked about.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, I think she's probably waking up because you're seeing it go down. It's down about, in the past year, it's down 6.7%. Last 3 months, it's down 1%, and you think for a bond fund is supposed to be relatively safe.
And what's
that's
the yield?
Not that safe. Yield 6.5%, but I believe that's including the yield. That's
6.7. Okay. So you're losing money. You're losing more and more money, and
yeah.
I think it's past time to get out of junk bonds.
Okay? Yeah. And
I never would have got into them, personally.
Yeah, and I think you're going to start seeing a lot of people who, we've said this before, we've been saying this for the last year plus, that people are chasing yield. They're going after that 6.5% yield, for example, on this one, and they think that's great, but you have to always realize there's risk versus reward, and when you're getting above average yield, you're likely getting above average risk as well.
Yeah, and junk bonds, period, are pretty risky over a long period of time. If we go into recession, mm-hmm. I think the default rate is like 20% plus mm-hmm. in junk bonds.
Yep.
Whereas in other bonds, it's 2 or 3%. I mean, it's really small, comparatively speaking,
yep.
and you're not getting the reward for that huge default risk. You're
exactly.
not getting enough interest rate. You're not getting enough yield, interest yield
so
from it.
Is this fund good? Is a high yield fund, is it a good fund?
Yeah.
I would say it's okay. Yeah. You know, it's not
in
terrible.
In its peer group, it's probably pretty decent.
Yeah, it's decent. I wouldn't say it's the best, but it also has pretty bad average credit quality, B, which is not very good.
It's a pretty junky. That's how they get in the 6%.
Exactly, 6.5%. Exactly.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Now, I don't know if you paid attention, but the Chinese just devalued their yuan, their money, today. They devalued it by 1.8%, okay? And we can get into the details of why they would do that, how they do that, but they devalued their money. Now, I asked Justin this, if they did that, and China is a big, didn't you tell me it was like 30% of the gold?
It's a third of the global gold demand.
Why did gold go up? Why did gold go up if they are buyers of gold and their money got worth less today?
Yeah. Significantly. And you would think the dollar would get stronger, which would weigh in commodities, and it really didn't.
And the dollar did not get stronger today.
Yeah, the dollar was UUP, which is a ETF with the dollar. It was not up or down. It was flat. And the reason is because if China is third of the global demand, and their currency now just got devalued by 2% overnight, and they're saying this is a one-time thing.
That's what the Chinese government is saying.
Yeah, it's not going to be a one-time thing. And why are they doing it? They're doing it because their exports are doing well.
Remember, they're still a very large export country. Even though they're trying to change that, they still are very dependent. Yep. Now, Justin, is this going to start another currency war? Are we going
to
have a currency war?
I mean, this is just, to me, we've been in a currency war for the last 5 or 6 years.
I think there's just another battle and a war that hasn't stopped.
Yeah, I think it's just another army coming to the battle.
Okay, but another question. If that's the case, why in the world would the Fed raise rates, which would make our currency be worth more? Mm-hmm. And therefore, we're losing the battle and the war. Why would they raise rates in this situation? Mm-hmm. We don't have inflation. They don't have to raise because of that. We don't have that strong of an economy. They're not raising because of that. And here you are, China's devaluing, and you know Japan and Europe and others might follow suit. And here we are going the opposite direction. We're giving up the war before we even try if we raise rates.
And you've seen the problems that the strong dollar has already created. Our industrials are weakening. Anything that is export related or export dependent in our country has weakened over the past year because of the strong dollar. And I think that's really what's holding the economy back.
And so will the Fed raise rates in September, everybody?
I think they will, but I think they will make it clear they won't do it again this year. And they're going to be very careful about the next one as well. And it could be a year before the next one.
It's possible. We've got time for your question before we're done for the day, everybody. I'm financial advisor Steve Pizza with Justin Klein, and this is Invest Talk.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, president. Steve and Justin get questions about good sources of information. There's a great resource for you on investtalk.com, a long list of time-tested books in 5 different categories. Look for recommended books on investtalk.com.
888-99-CHART. We're going to go talk to Jim in Chula Vista. How you doing, Jim?
Doing fine. I wonder what your opinion was on a stock with a symbol of GASS, Delft Gas. It's selling for about a third a book, and I bought some today, but I don't understand why it's so cheap when you look at the fundamentals of it.
Okay, let's talk about it. This is Stealth Gas, Inc. It's a shipper, provides international seaborne transportation services for petroleum and petrochemical products with 45 vessels. And that's why it's cheap. Think what it does. It transports oil and oil petrochemical products. And what has oil been doing? Going down, 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 down. And you look at the fundamentals and you say, hey, this is a fairly inexpensive stock. But remember, you also look at its earnings, and the earnings have not, quarter over quarter, have not done that stellar. They've gone down, down, down. At $1.18 in 2012, and this year it's going to be 68 cents. Oh, yeah, it's up higher than last year, and it's going to be up more in 2016, but at 83 cents.
Yeah, and its profitability has really never been that great. Back in 2005, it was at 16% return on equity, but it's been in a steady decline since then, and the return on equity right now is 2%.
Which is very low.
Very low. And they're increasing their shares outstanding from about 21 million in 2012 to 41 million today. So they've almost doubled their shares in
And at the same time, they've been repurchasing $10 million worth of common stock outstanding.
Well, they just announced that they were. You know, because probably because they see that they're under book value, 0.38. So from a book value perspective,
it's cheap.
Sure, it's cheap, but every other metric, it's not cheap.
Yeah. So you don't look at just one. Make sure you look at them all, Jim. But that's why. Right. That's why. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call,
okay,
Jim.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
GASS gas.
Stealth gas.
So that's what that company is. 888-99-CHART. 888-992-4278. We've had a lot of economic numbers come out recently, and they have been kind of mixed. I'm going to say that they've been kind of positive when it comes to jobs, but there's other things, are like productivity is really not very good. We're half as productive as we were, and productivity growth, I should say. The growth is half of what it was, you know, before 2007. How come we're so unproductive when we were so much more productive back then? That really goes to standard of living for everybody. The better your standard of living, the more productive you are, the better standard of living we have. Mm-hmm. And salaries haven't really increased.
Well, and also the mantra of corporations over the past 5 or 6 years has been to cut costs, right? To reduce employee headcount and become more efficient, et cetera. But you can only do that for so long and squeeze so much productivity out of your employees before you hit a wall. And I think over the past year or so, corporations have hit a wall of cutting employees and cutting overhead costs, but also getting positive things out of their employees, and it's becoming more and more difficult.
And they haven't really picked up very much at all their capital spending. In other words, building new factories, having new software or computer hardware. They haven't really spent that much money, and yet they have huge profits. And that hurts increasing productivity and hurts the economy overall because they're not spending. And then you add into the fact that consumers have kind of closed their wallets a little bit in the last couple of quarters. And then you got an economy that's growing 2% instead of 3%.
I think it's on average over the past the first two quarters is 1.5% because you had 0.2 and you had – or no, you had 0.6. 0.6 in the first quarter and 0.3 in the second quarter.
No.
So 1.3, sorry, 1.3 in the second quarter. So take that together on average, that's about 1.5%.
Yeah, so that's what we're looking at. But it's probably going to be 2% by the end of the year. That's what I'm thinking. But that's not good.
No.
So – I'm not saying – I don't think we're headed into recession this year. I don't see it happening. I'm not so positive about next year, though, or the year after. There's a lot of – as we were talking about earlier on the show, a lot of little red flags that are pointing to hard times ahead.
Yeah, and usually when – if we do have a large pullback, that's going to hit economic spending, you know, consumer spending to some degree. And the big question is, how much will it hit consumer spending? And then you'll know whether a pullback in the market will cause a recession.
Okay, we're out of time today, everybody. I'm financial advisor Steve Peasley, along with Justin Klein and everyone at KPP Financial. I thank you for listening. We appreciate it. I hope you have a good evening. And let's do this again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.